I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. He's come under fire from those who say they lost their livelihoods to the Gulf oil spill. He's been criticized for working too slowly, not listening, being insensitive to people's needs. And we're not talking about the chair of BP. We're talking about the man charged with putting things right. Today, we check in with Kenneth Feinberg. He first supervised the 9/11 Victims Fund. Now he's tasked with doling out billions of dollars from the Gulf Coast Claims Fund. But first, Libya. Over the past week, the North African nation has been shaken by protests and a violent crackdown by the government, a crackdown that is said to include the use of thousands of foreign mercenaries. Libya's strongman leader Muammar Gaddafi said yesterday in a rambling speech to his country that he will fight to the end.
I will not leave the country, and I will die, and I will die as a martyr at the end.
The speech was carried by Al Jazeera, which is where we got that clip. Colonel Gaddafi calls himself a revolutionary and has ruled Libya for the past 42 years. In that time, he's championed pan-Arab rights and pan-African rights. In fact, he was instrumental in the foundation of the African Union. We wanted to know more about the relationship between the rest of the continent and Libya, so we've called upon two analysts who know the region well. Abdurrahim Fukara is the Washington bureau chief for Al Jazeera International, which has been leading the coverage of the events in Libya, Tunisia, Egypt, and elsewhere in the region. Also with us, Africa watcher Amira Woods. She's co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus, a program with the think tank, the Institute for Policy Studies. And they're both here with us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Welcome to you both. Thank you both so much for joining us once again.
Great to be with you.
Abdurrahim, I was noting that Gaddafi is the longest serving leader, if I have that right, in both Africa and the Arab world. How has he held on to power for so long?
Well, it's interesting how he went from being the hero of millions of not just Egyptians, but the millions of Arabs beyond Libya, and also in other parts of the world, sub-Saharan Africa, Latin America, to being a tragic hero in the ancient Greek sense of it now, where people just want him to go.
But he's known in the West for what many people view as his just erratic personal behavior, attended by, you know, female bodyguards, attended by a Ukrainian so-called nurse. I mean, this was what, you know, Westerners see when he's come, for example, to address the United Nations. So given his what seems to be some very erratic, many people consider disturbed kind of personal behavior, how has he managed to hold on to power?
Well, I mean, it's a combination of two things. One, Gaddafi has always sold himself to people inside Libya and outside as a revolutionary against imperialism, against colonialism, against the West, and so on. And that's how he's consolidated his hold on power.
Abdurrahim mentioned that he had tried to become kind of a regional pan-Arab leader. That doesn't seem to have gone very well. He's also turned his attention to, you know, the rest of the continent. How is he viewed in the rest of the continent? He's still invited to Arab Union meetings. He's still a key player at these meetings and so forth. Amira, so talk about that, if you would.
In fact, Gaddafi played both roles. He had one foot in the Arab League and was, in fact, chair of the Arab League, while also having one foot in the African Union. And up through January of this year, he was chair of the African Union, providing leadership for the Pan-African body and actually putting forward some courageous stances. He was calling for greater trade within the region. He was calling for even a joint currency and greater customs union within the African continent. So there was a Pan-African vision that many people embraced that Gaddafi actually promoted, while at the same time there was this sort of schizophrenia that I think you reference, where, you know, Gaddafi would also be funneling resources, tremendous resources, to rebel forces. I'm from Liberia, you know, Michelle, and that history goes back to the 1980s when Charles Taylor got his weapons and training from Libya at a time when Libya was standing up against the U.S. and saw Taylor as his person to help counteract U.S. dominance in the West African region.
Talk to me, if you would, though, about the foreign mercenaries aspect, because it's been widely reported that there are thousands of foreign mercenaries sort of acting on his behalf, firing indiscriminately at protesters and acting sort of in behalf of keeping him in power. Why are they there?
Well, first we have to say, you know, a lot of these reports we're getting from Al Jazeera and from reactions on the ground, many of them have to be validated. But what we're hearing is that there are people whose skin color is dark who are speaking French or other languages. And what we know is that there's been a relationship that Gaddafi has had with rebel forces, whether in Mali or even in Darfur and Sudan, in a number of countries where Gaddafi was seen as providing financial and, in fact, political backing to some of these rebel forces. So I think there is almost a relationship that's been in place going back, in some instances, a decade or more. And that relationship could make it easy for Gaddafi to then call in the chips and say, you know, we need some added forces here to support him in his quest to hold on to power.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking about events in Libya. We're speaking with Amira Woods. That's who you just heard, of the Institute for Policy Studies. She's there. Africa expert. We're also with us Abdurrahim Fukara of Al Jazeera International. We're talking about Libya and what it could mean for the rest of the continent. I also want to mention that for Americans, Gaddafi might be best known or most widely viewed as a sponsor of international terrorism, dating particularly to the 1988 bombing of the Pan Am flight over Lockerbie in Scotland, resulting in, you know, UN sanctions and isolating Libya considerably. And then in 2003, Gaddafi relinquished his inventory of weapons of mass destruction. Libya eventually claimed responsibility for this, for the perpetrator was, you know, arrested. But then when he was released in 2009, received a hero's welcome in Libya, which kind of reawakened a lot of feelings of anger. But I did want to ask you, Abdurrahim, what are the conditions in Libya that you feel that your reporting indicates have led to this? You know, in Egypt, we've talked a lot about how, you know, economic progress has stalled. Political progress has stalled. What about Libya? It is an oil-rich country.
Libya is not only an oil-rich country, it has a far, far smaller population than Egypt or even Tunisia, 6 million people. And you think that for the oil revenues of Libya, which vary between $30 and $40 billion annually, you think that those 6 million people would actually be living in a North African paradise. They are not. Unemployment is rife. In parts of Libya, there's no infrastructure, and a lot of people feel that they just have not been part of that oil bonanza in Libya. Where has the money gone? It has been lavished on various movements in Africa. It was lavished in the 80s, for example, on the Irish Republican Army in Europe. So all this now is coming back to roost, and Libyans are saying, in more or less what we heard in Tunisia, not only have our social and economic conditions been bad, but the freedoms that we were supposed to have enjoyed were under the revolution of the leader, Muammar Gaddafi, we haven't had them.
And finally, before we let you go, Abdurrahim, we've been asking you consistently, and you've been very good about kind of keeping us apprised of events, you know, throughout the region. When we watched events in Egypt, you were also, first it was Tunisia, and then it was Egypt, and also there have been protests in Bahrain, and now in Libya. Are there other countries that we should also be keeping an eye on? And Amir, I'm going to ask you the same question, particularly about Sudan.
I think absolutely. I think every country should be watched, because we don't know where this thing is going to go next. It's interesting that he gave the first sign that things may be coming to Libya after the president of Tunisia fled. 2 days later, he gave a speech in which he told Tunisians, you should have kept President Ben Ali for life because he's the best thing you've ever had. And he was obviously talking about himself. He was talking to Libyans by talking to Tunisians. Just want to say quickly that in various parts of the continent in 2011 will see about elections in about 20 different countries. Everyone is watching what's going on in Libya. Everyone has been watching what's going on in Egypt. And people in sub-Saharan Africa may not have had their own Al Jazeera to actually bring attention to what's going on in their countries. But they are watching what's going on in North Africa. They may not have oil, although Nigeria and other countries in sub-Saharan Africa are oil exporters. But I think it is really a shame that yet so much attention has been focused on North Africa, especially Egypt, because of U.S. National security, because of Israel, because of oil, because of all this. And very, very little attention is being paid to the rest of the continent.
So, Amira, if you would give us a final thought on that. Abdurrahim was telling us, you know, of the 53 countries, now 54, with the referendum in Sudan. Elections in 20 countries coming up in this year. And now we find, in speaking of Sudan, that President Omar al-Bashir says he's not going to run for re-election. Is this a surprising development?
Well, it is a surprising development in Sudan, but I think we have to recognize that in Sudan...
Well, I do want to mention that elections would be held in 2015,
right.
So this is rather far off in any case.
But I do think it is important to recognize that the students in Khartoum have been organizing. There have been demonstrations in the streets led by students. You have seen also demonstrations in Gabon, in Cameroon. The list of countries, the list is growing. And I think the commonality is in each of those countries... You have very repressive governments that have been in power for much too long, for decades, sometimes two or three decades. You have young people, this youth bulge that people talk about, but young people who are educated for the large part and cannot find jobs that are taking to the streets. And you have economic discontent, people who cannot put food on the table to feed their children. There is a sense that people must have their voices heard, must have their will respected. And Tunisia, Egypt, you have seen that there's this change that's underway, a change where people feel like their power can be expressed.
Amira Woods is co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. She was here with us in our Washington, D.C. studio, along with Abdurrahim Foukara, Washington Bureau Chief for Al Jazeera International. I thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you, Michelle.